That Great Business Show, Ireland's best business podcast.
ThatGreatBusinessShow.com is brought to you by De Facto Shaving Oil, the best anyone can get. Made in Ireland, sold worldwide.
Welcome to episode 94 of That Great Business Show, posting on the 1st of July, 2022. Faltister. Most listened to podcast since the start of the year has been my interview with Professor Martin Curley of the HSE, who has taken ownership of bringing the Irish health service into the 21st century by adopting a fabulous range of medtech solutions that he name checks. He's on episode 90. Another that caught some attention was economist Alan McQuaid's rant on episode 93. Many people asking the same questions he does. Why can't we make things like housing better by doing things better? If you haven't heard Alan on episode 93, his candor will bring a smile to your face. On this episode, we have two great business ideas for you. One that will get you into the food business for about €10,000. The other, an idea that will take a little longer to grow, but you don't have to do too much, if any work at all, as its value grows itself. And if your business logo is associated with a colour, well, we have news for you. Businesses, including the estate of the late rock star Prince, are trying to copyright colours, and some are succeeding. All of these great insights are brought to you, as always, thanks to De Facto Shaving Oil, the world's best shaving oil, not a beard oil, made in Mayo, sold worldwide.
De Facto Shaving Oil, smooth as.
Now, anyone in broadcast loves a good voice or a great accent, and for that reason alone, I would have had my first guest on That Great Business Show just to have him read the phone book. And if you don't know what the phone book is, go ask your mammy. Seanie McCleary is co-founder with Nikita McRory of two businesses. One is Bluster Street Kitchen, and the other is Street School. Street, in this case, is spelled S-T-R-E-A-T. And that's the one I'm most interested in for our listeners, Team GBS. Because Seanie says he can have you up and running your own food business for the guts of just €10,000, give or take a bit of VAT. So let me start by sitting back and just listening to the great voice of Seanie McCleary. Welcome to That Great Business Show.
Yeah, thanks a million for having me on. No pressure with the accent thing, you know, straight out of Monaghan City.
What you've just told me is the real reason you're here is that you've got three little kids under 3 years old, yourself and Nikita.
Yeah, basically I go and do stuff like this to get away from all the real work at home, like, you know, I'm probably not the only one.
Street is, you give not alone advice, you're a business advice centre for people who want to get into the street food business.
Yeah, so basically we set up Street School, I suppose, late 2019, just before the whole pandemic kicked off and
good
everything.
Good timing, eh?
It's all about timing, isn't it? Like, that's one thing I've learned along the way is ideas and money are obviously important, but timing is key in everything, you know, in business. So yeah, I set it up in late 2019. We moved back to Ireland 2017 and wanted to set up a street food kind of catering food truck hire business. And it was such a grey area. It was so, like, there's nowhere to go to for advice. Anyone that is doing reasonably well at it back then, they don't want to tell you anything. You go to your enterprise boards, whatever, social welfare departments and stuff, and it's just, there's no advice.
Oh, well, you're not expecting social welfare to tell you how to set up a street food business.
Well, funny, we come back to Ireland from Australia and stuff. We were away for 5 years, a few different places and that, but we heard that you could come back, get some sort of a scheme where you could set up your own business and get a part payment from the government for a couple of years to get it up and running.
There is a program called Back for Business.
Yes, there is.
Yeah.
And when we moved back to the country, we were told the only way for us to avail of it at the time was to sign on the live register for 9 months, and we wanted to start kind of the following Monday.
Okay.
Now, maybe it has pivoted a bit now. Yeah. It was the back to work enterprise allowance. So it was kind of incentivizing people back to work or business.
Now, this is a program run by a woman called Paula Fitzsimons, a big friend of the show. But anyway, back to street school.
So what took us basically 2 years really to find our feet and setting up Blast the Street Kitchen. We did the markets, we did the gazebos, we bought our first trailer off, let's say, a shady character for an unknown amount of money. No receipts were exchanged, and it was just a disaster from dealing with the HSE, trying to get it registered, trying to get advice on even back to basics of business, you know, should we register in Ireland as a sole trader, a partnership, a limited company? No advice really out there, because I suppose it wasn't that.
On your website, you've got a big, nice things that you're saying about the LEO, your local enterprise office.
Yeah, so we have been supported by local enterprise office, particularly, I suppose, the last few years. And look, it's not the first couple of years, it was probably hard for them to kind of see a future in that type of business. You know, as they said to me, the failure rate in food businesses, Sean, is so high, never mind, you know, this kind of unknown.
But ironically, timing was everything, because what got popular during COVID? Street food. Trailer food, if I want to call it that.
Yeah. So taking it back a wee step, what we wanted to do was, right, 2 years into Blasta, we felt like we knew enough to kind of keep our own business tipping away. And now let's go back and look at how, what we can do to help others. We are nominated for Best Emerging Franchise with the Irish Franchise Association. And at that stage, we started to meet potential franchisees. People were approaching us. They wanted to potentially franchise Blasta. But the more I got to know and talk to these people, I realized, hold on a minute, they're not passionate about Blasta, obviously. That was our own story. They love the business in a box idea, right? So they love turnkey. We do all the hard work. They just kind of come along and open up. And that's when we kind of started contacting them back, maybe, and saying, Connell or Mary or John, I tell you what, the Blasta thing, we're going to park it right now. But you did seem very passionate about jerk chicken, South African barbecue, Asian street food, whatever it was. And at that stage, we would then say, look, we'll create a brand for you. We'll sell you a trailer. We'll brand it. We'll help you create menus, build you a presence online. And that was it, the plan at the start. I remember, we just looked back recently enough on the kind of sales projections and, you know, how this would, I wanted to set up 5 or 6 different street food concepts every year for young couples or whoever it may be, friends, families, and just grow a portfolio over time while growing our own business. And then boom, lockdown, pandemic. Quickly, I know pivot, such an overused word now, like, well, we had to pivot, and it was made a bit easier for us because people came to us. So it went from the John and Mary's, the couples, the families, brothers and sisters and friends, to commercial directors of hotel groups, hospitality groups, charities, actually social enterprises. Everyone was looking for a way to kind of get out on the street in a safe environment, bring their brand direct to customers, consumers, and do so in that kind of street food manner. And we were the only place to go to, I suppose, for everything under one roof. You
and
know.
Lucky you, or clever you, the fact that you were the only one, because you had thought this through.
Yeah, I suppose we could fast track all the pains that we went through in 2-3 years to basically, look, here's what we can do. Let's go. We're turning around businesses in 7 days from the hardware. While the trailer, let's say we were importing trailers going back 3 years ago. During COVID then, with shipping and importing, I just started to look at actually manufacturing trailers here in Ireland, which again, that was a very taboo area. And what we were doing then, we moved away from importing to kind of importing parts of the trailer, building them here. And now actually, we'll talk about this more, but in the last 6 months, we've actually set up a factory here where we manufacture fully fiberglass food and coffee trailers.
You are a right little entrepreneur, aren't you?
Yeah.
You see opportunity everywhere.
By default, I guess. But
had no background in food.
I had background in food. Now, I did a degree in archaeology, science.
Yeah, but that's what I mean.
But food, I've been hands-on with food since 14, 15, working in kind of hotel kitchens and everything else. Always had the entrepreneurial mindset. It's like an affliction.
It is.
Since I was in good nappies, one, I think. Yeah.
So can I go down to Shawnee and say, Shawnee, give us a trailer and set me up for €10,000?
Yeah, so right now we're doing a package where for €10,000 plus VAT, we'll hand you a branded trailer. Now, you might have your own brand. We can just apply that, or else for an extra cost, we can offer you a full design service where we can take someone might have whipped up a wee logo during lockdown. Fiona, our head of design, can take that and kind of pull more ideas out of you, show you how your trailer could look to maximize exposure, you know, maybe design flyers, leaflets, digital marketing content and stuff, you know. But generally for about €10,000 plus VAT, you're inside a branded trailer, and now it's up to you, or you can come back to us for advice on how
The advice, because then you give, is it fine? There's a 5 or 7 hour tutorial thing that you do.
We've got it down now. It's all about streamlining it. So we've got it down to a 3.5 hour workshop now. There's two different kind of.
And in 3.5 hours, you will teach me how to run my street food business.
You might never want to see me again after the 3.5 hours, but you'll be sure of whether this is what you want to do or not, you know. So to give you an idea, the 3.5 hours, we cover registration with the HSE, registration with revenue with CRO, picking a name, building a brand, costing and planning a menu, looking at actually what your idea is and is it feasible, where are you located and is that business model that you had thought of as feasible. 90% of people that come in with an idea leave with a tweaked version of that idea. So I'll give you an example of what a lot of food trucks do, right, is let's say, and I'm thinking of one example, hopefully they're listening because they're two entrepreneurs as well and fans of the pod, but
they're very welcome to come in. We love people being recommended, so you can recommend them.
Yeah, yeah. So two lads from Limerick, two good friends, finished their degrees and wanted to set up a trailer called Burrito Boys, right? The problem is straight away you're pigeonholing yourself in one type of food, burrito. Unless you really understand your footfall, your cost of sale of handing over that burrito, what we would do then is suggest, let's tweak something. Look at Blastistry Kitchen, my own business. Again, I didn't really know this at the time, but I was able to keep it quite generalized. So Blastistry, we can change around and do South American sandwiches, tacos, burgers, hot dogs, nachos. Burrito Boys, you're expected to obviously have burritos in the menu every day. Now, the cost of a burrito, unless you have a very high footfall day, there's a lot of waste in it, a lot of rice, a lot of meats, beans and stuff, you know. So anyway, just a quick talk to the lads and we come up with a name. And you can look them up now, Casa Street Kitchen, right? So again,
Casa, C-A-S-A?
C-A-S-A. So that's kind of just how Street Kitchen, like a bit more generalized, but again, fun and funky branding. But it gives them a lot more creativity, like to play around with menus and everything else. And as again, if you're kind of tapping into corporate bookings and someone sees Burrito Boys, you know, okay, right, we'll get you once. But then the next time, well, we want something else different from burritos. Whereas now you can kind of provide a full package or different varying menu items, you know.
So I set up my Casa Connell or Casa Connell kitchen, pay you 10 grand plus VAT, plus a little bit of consultancy because there is, for those 3.5 hours, I pay you 500 euro or something.
Yeah, we've got a special rate, 595 for startups and 995 for existing companies or food brands, basically.
Is there anything you don't sell?
I'm not answering that right now, no.
How much money can I make out of my food truck?
The good thing about this type of business, and this is a big selling point, we've experienced it ourselves. It's all about what you want to put in, what you want to take out, about flexibility. So if you want to work 7 days a week, I'll take, for example, Kildare Village. You'll see food trucks there. We would know them all quite well. They operate 7 days a week. They operate between 10 and 13 hours a day, you know, so you can expect a very different turnover there. Plus, obviously, though, the turnover is one thing. The cost of running that is obviously much higher. So everything I would say is quite relative. We've set up couples who, for example, still work part-time, but they would go off on a Saturday, Sunday. Kids are a bit older maybe, and they might do festivals and that kind of scene. Generally, we have customers doing anything from 100,000 to 400,000 a year turnover. And that can be anything from two owner-operated clients of ours right up to, we'd have a couple of clients with multiple units who would never step foot inside them. They just want to hire people to run the whole show for them and build a brand with the aim to potentially selling the brand, you know. So it's a complete mixed bag.
And that big question, how big is the margin?
The margin can be quite healthy. And when you take in, now I can talk about this part for a long time, take in the costs of overheads of a restaurant, right? I'm not putting down obviously any cafe or restaurant owners. A lot of good friends of ours are in the business. But as prices right now have went through the roof, that cost has to be redeemed back from somewhere. So it's going to be the quality of food. It's going to be, you'll see a lot of places now maybe not rehiring chefs and rather kind of buying in the pre-cooked, the ready-made type stuff and training up maybe less skilled staff. Basically, it comes with a price, whereas street food, you've got quite fixed costs. Now, look, packaging has been a big hit for us. We set up everyone with compostable packaging.
It looks really smart. I've saw it online.
Yeah, and it can be really, look, it just adds that premium touch for a brand, you know. But the cost of compostable packaging has went up sky high. Although funny, a lot of the plastics we found have been relatively stagnant in price. So you're nearly getting crucified for that end of things. But generally, other than your gas and your kind of packaging, your fixed costs are relatively settled compared to a restaurant now, you know.
So the margin.
Well,
I'm still trying to figure out kind of a living.
Yeah. A restaurant will have its money makers and it will have its kind of get you in the door type dishes. And look, that varies. The margin is very much down to the food business itself, I would say. And I'll tell you a good example, right? If you take a traditional chipper, they're taking a chicken breast, they're dredging it in corn flour and seasoning and stuff. They're deep frying it. And often people won't want to pay more than €4 for a chicken breast, for a chicken fillet or whatever. Right? Take the same chicken breast, slice it up, put it in curry sauce and serve it with rice. You're getting 11.50, 12.50, 13, €14. Add a Thai theme to that and it's up again, you know. So again, it's very much, that's something I'm actually quite passionate about, is training people or discussing at least with them the profitability piece. You're not trying to completely rip people off at all, but there is ways of adding value to it and making your nice little margin there, you know.
So how many people have gone through street school and are still in business?
We set up 106 food trucks in the last 2 years.
And what was your original, the business plan? What did you expect to do?
In the first 3 years, 24 food trucks.
Oh, geez.
So we're only about 2 years and a couple of months in. The hardest part of it all isn't actually the street school piece. It's actually continuing to run and grow my own business on the side. And I really am passionate about that.
The big question, though, can you really grow it much bigger?
The street school piece? Yeah. So I'll give you an idea of what we're at really with street school at the minute. I suppose, again, back to this pivot, and it's by default, is started off wanting to help startups, people like ourselves, maybe moving back to Ireland or just quit, you know, finding a new way of life. Then it moved into B2B, hotels, bars, restaurant, any pub owner who had a car park outside not being utilised, let's put a coffee truck in it. You know, he was...
They're being chased by the planners now.
And one of your favourite we sayings is sweat the acid. Sweat the acid. So that's, again, back to a lesson I learned in Australia. I worked for a guy on the side who ran three food trucks and we would have catered the Australian Grand Prix, the Australian Open tennis and everything.
Big.
This guy had one warehouse and as he said, he needs to sweat that asset as much as possible. So rather than running one food truck out of it, he ran two, then he ran three and then he ended up supplying his own cafe out of it and stuff. So then it went to, so these bars had to kind of obviously make the bills kept coming in, the electricity, the water bills. So it made sense for them maybe to put this out the front. We would train up staff. So the next step then was food brands started contacting us, retail food brands, craft breweries, in-store tastings. And I learned a lot about this through the Food Academy of Super Value, doing my own product range and stuff. Companies really rely on in-store tastings, demonstrations, brand activations in shopping centres. This was all wiped out and continue. Like you'll still not see any happening in stores now. So again, we by default had this solution for all these brands. Come to us. We'll give you a branded, put your brand on this unit and we will connect you with various outlets that we've built a lot of corporate relationships over the last few years, shopping centres, retail outlets. So we could take these food brands and say, look, we'll give you a full package. We'll get you in this unit. We'll take your product or you take your product and demonstrate it at, here's a list of festivals, here's a list of outlets. So now we're working with a lot of kind of ready meal brands, Irish food companies.
Again, I was on your website. The number of festivals, it's infinite. I had no idea how many that there are. Now, you know, the big ones.
Yeah.
But you've kind of gone into the micro detail.
Yeah, I think a lot of people underestimate the boutique festivals, the smaller festivals, the Irish language festivals, culture festivals. And it's almost like when you take Dublin, for example, a lot of people underestimate what's outside of Dublin. You know, so there's a huge market.
There seems to be a car event everywhere, every month. I just looked as I went through it, and I'd have an interest in cars, which I picked out. Everywhere, there's vintage car events.
Yeah, hundreds, if not thousands of people going to these shows, you know. So I find a lot of people, even not from Dublin, they think that the ultimate goal is, well, I want to set up a food truck and try and get into Dublin. I'm actually going the opposite way. I'm telling the Dubs, you need to set up a food truck and try and get out of Dublin. There's so much happening out here. This, like, straight up now, if someone rings me and they want to set up a coffee truck in Dublin, it is becoming very saturated, you know. Dublin City Council aren't giving out really any licenses and stuff anymore. So there's a lot of opportunity outside.
So if I go to Monaghan, for example, can I get a license handy? Is it expensive? How much does it cost to buy a pitch wherever?
Or does it depend? But the way it works generally is you contact a county council, for example, and I think a lot of people think this is how it works, right? You walk in or you ring the council and they say, oh, sure, work away. You tell us where you want to go and we'll make up a price. But no, it's, to be honest, most of the systems are very outdated because you contact the council and they'll send you out a map, a municipal district map from maybe 1980 and say, here's three X's on here. You choose one of them and you might choose one and they say, oh, that's taken. Some of them are actually paid up by business owners, so you'll never be able to use that spot, you know, so there's quite a
sneaky
bit of monopoly going on there, but there is other ways outside of that. You know, you can trade on private property with permission of landowner as long as you have all your kind of relevant documentation with the revenue, HSE and stuff like that. And this is all the stuff we would train people up on the workshop side of things. So a pitch, I'll give you an example now. A normal pitch for a county council spot, if you were lucky enough to get one, anything from 2,500 to 6,000 euro a year. But it comes with all the small writing. You can't open until 6 p.m. in the evening, which is very outdated. So if you take us, for example, in Monaghan, something I'm working on, hopefully to change, you can't trade until after 6 p.m. in the evening. Whereas we're going all out to create fresh, vibrant kind of food, compostable packaging, and it's very much daytime food, you know. Then you have the point, the other side of it is power supply. I've been arguing with certain councils for years now to put in electrical power supplies for each pitch, even if it means charging the likes of us more. But again, the likes of myself, which is why we don't really, we've moved into a lot of corporate catering and weddings. But if you're in a council spot, often you have to still use a generator. So now you've got Muggins here spending a fortune on compostable packaging, wooden cutlery, napkins, and then pulling out a big diesel generator to serve tacos for 3 hours, you know. So
plus noise.
That has to change, and the noise and many other parts of it as well. And remember, it always reminds me of working outside Croke Park when I was 14, 15, in a big chip van for a guy I worked for a few years. It was great crack, but everything smelled like petrol. Everything, the food, the packaging,
probably
your clothes for a
maybe
week
it was
afterwards.
For the better. Do those lads, look at them, just always curious about everybody's business. Do the lads outside of Croke Park make a fortune?
Yeah, there's massive money to be made there.
Bad, isn't it?
And there's a lot of, there's a bit of an underbelly there too. Like, you're paying off local pub owners, you're paying off ticket touts, they're paying off people to park 4 or 5 cars in a row. And when you pull up, these 4 or 5 guys magically appear and make the cars disappear. So you get the prime position. I can never understand why this lovely bar owner was always bringing us over Red Bull and Lucozade, and we were kids. We thought this was brilliant, you know. And there was a good sum of cash that was involved that I realised a few years later. So that's, yeah, especially around the Dublin, the Aviva Stadiums, all that kind of thing. It's crazy to see in action.
I love those insider tips. So give me 2 or 3 more. If you are going to advise me, first of all, you've told me do not set up my coffee shop in Dublin. What else would you not do or do?
And even, I'm not just saying not to do it in Dublin, but there is other ways of, you're not just always looking for a pitch to go 5, 6, 7 days a week. A big mistake I see people making all the time is they try and please everyone, or they don't want to miss anyone. So they'll open from 7 in the morning and they're nearly still there at 7 in the evening. So really they're working from 5:30 till 9:30 at night, you know, when you take in the setting up, the cleaning, the moving. So I would always say keep your hours concise, build a good brand online and let people know that you're only open from 10 to 2, 10 to 3, 11 to 3, whatever it is. And people, it'll take a while, but people will adapt that. I know you might not get everyone, but often you see someone will set up and I'd say, oh guys, why did you start opening at 8, 7, 6:30? Oh, you see, there's lovely gentlemen or two couples, they always walk past here and go to work and they'd love our wee coffee in the morning. But you take that 20 or 40 quid you might have made in them first 3 hours, factoring staff, costs, opening, everything, and your time. Like, you could talk all day, but you know, people don't value their time enough. And again, it's back to the workshop that I deliver. When I took a bit of investment on board at the early stages of this business, just from an angel investor who's still a very good mentor of mine, and he was saying, how much are you charging these people to do this workshop? And I says, €180 for 3 hours. So it's 60 quid an hour. You know, I'm delighted. You need to multiply that by 5. And I said, gee, I was laughing, like saying, geez, no way. Like, he said, well, you think, how long did it take you to learn everything that you're teaching them? What pains did you have to go through? Like, you know, you're not crediting the value that you're adding enough. And someday you'll pay. Someday you'll train someone to set up and they'll end up being in competition with you. And, you know, you'll feel the direct, you know, and he was kind of right, I suppose, in a way. And I eventually did. And workshops, 3 times busier because you're filtering out all the, what would have happened back then, and this is only going back a couple of years, but when the price was much lower, you would get a disgruntled chef waking up on a Monday morning, no, I'm not going back to work, and he'd ring you and he wants to do a workshop, and then he might show up for the workshop, and that, you know, or even if they paid for it and they still don't show up, it's still a waste of my time, you know. And when you put the price up that bit higher and you really put, see the value that you're adding, you know, it was completely different clientele, a lot of businesses, a lot of cafes. Yeah, just, it was interesting, you know.
2 further questions before we finish. One is, can you go international?
With Street School, we have exported a few units and trailers and stuff. Now, that's completely no advertising at all.
To where?
So a few to mainland UK, 1 randomly to Bulgaria. I'm talking to a lady now from Croatia.
How did the Bulgarian find you?
An Irishman, actually, who owns a haulage company who lives over there and stuff. And it was a friend or a colleague of his setting up a coffee business over there. And because he's back and forth, it made sense. And then I actually was talking to him about opportunities in kind of continuing that, you know. But absolutely. And the reason we haven't even put our focus on that yet. We're building a few plans behind the scenes, is we want to be fully manufacturing and having control over everything we make here. So yeah, over the last 6 to 9 months, with backing from local enterprise office, we've built a manufacturing facility in Monaghan. So everything is built and sourced from scratch there. The chassis of the trailer, I put my life savings into making molds for the fiberglass so we can make the bodies all identical shaped so we can be known for that shape. You've probably seen them around, they're like cylindrical.
I've seen them on your website, yeah.
So now that we have full control over that, export will definitely, it's on the horizon, you know. It's worth mentioning as well, right? And I'm surprised you didn't ask this already. A lot of people do. It's like an FAQ with the startups, right? A trailer license to tow this trailer, right? It's the only one in Ireland and the UK that can be towed on a standard car license.
Okay.
So we purposely make them below 750 kilos.
Okay.
Our trailers are about 610 kilos gross weight.
And were you expecting me to ask that question? I wouldn't know that.
Not you. I'm saying just the people that ring us randomly out of the blue. It's like, come here, Ed, what type of license do I need to tow these trailers? No license. Straight, like it's a massive unique selling point for us.
Oh, yeah.
Of our startup customers as well, between 70 and 75% were young female entrepreneurs, 25 to 35.
Really? That's brilliant.
So it's a massive demographic, yeah.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's not sexist, I hope at all, but you know, they love the independence of this is their unit. They can get it branded with us any way they want. They can hook it on. We've got a customer just over the border in Northern Ireland driving this around in a black and gold Mini Cooper. But at the same time, you can have three people working inside it, you know. So that, again, back to my own, solved my own problem when I moved back to Ireland. I had no car license either. My partner hadn't either. We just never needed to drive. We'd always lived in cities around the world and in Monaghan. So when we did start driving, I wanted something light. Again, I met this shady character, bought this trailer, far too big, disaster of a thing. I said, the next trailer we get will be a bit more petite and manageable. So yeah, we imported a trailer at the time directly from China, actually, which was a bit risky. And slowly over the next few years, kind of reverse engineered them and started making them here, basically. But yeah, unique selling point for us definitely is standard car license can tow these things anywhere. You know?
Come here to me. Your last question. Hire in a heartbeat. Who would you hire in a heartbeat?
I nearly forgot about that part. I knew it was coming up. I was listening to a podcast on the way down the road here with Mr. Clancy of Enterprise Ireland. I was thinking, he'd be handy to have on board.
He would be very handy.
But no, I have thought about this. I would hire Naomi Cullen. Naomi Cullen is commercial manager for Manna Drone Delivery.
We know Manna because I met Bobby Healy in here 2 or 3 weeks ago. Actually, yeah.
So I coordinate a lot of the hot food for the Manna Drone Delivery in Balbriggan and work closely with them. And Naomi, it's the first time I think I've met anyone with as much. She's bursting with energy, organized, an entrepreneur. Yeah, I've never actually really used that word much, but really much an entrepreneur within another company. And yeah, I remember meeting her on the roof in Balbriggan maybe over a year ago now, telling me about how we're going to have offices up here and drones and it's going to be crazy and food trucks. And
it's happening.
It happened. No one ever thought it would happen.
I was watching, I can't remember, there's one of the huge international companies which has now gone live with, I think, 10,000 drones. Like drones are real, happening.
Yeah, no, it's great. Yeah. When I started with Manna, we were doing 7 deliveries a day. We're doing 120, 125 deliveries at the minute, you know, hoping to hit 200 soon. So it's crazy. So fabulous. Seeing that come to life, yeah. Naomi, you're hired if you're listening to this.
She is definitely hired. Naomi, come. Come here to me. I'm sending you back to Nikita because she wants you to pick up those three kids.
I'm going to eat a lot of food around Dundrum here first. But yeah, no, thanks a million for having me on.
You're very welcome. That is Seanie McCleary of Street School and others. Anybody wants to find you will find you on Street School. And spelling Street School, STREAT. Very funny, very punny. Thanks, Seanie.
Cheers.
For joining us on That Great Business Show.
Thinking of travel? If so, make sure to make Defacto, the world's best shaving oil, your choice of travel companion. A 25-milliliter bottle of Defacto means no hassle at airports, no bulky cans to carry, and the guarantee of the world's best shave. DefactoShave.com.
Everyday accounting can be a bit of a drama for SMEs. However, BigRedCloud.com takes the drama away with its simple and easy-to-use cloud-based accounting and payroll software designed for SME owners. Raise and send invoices, manage VAT reports and obligations, run management reports, link directly to Irish banks, automatically import purchase invoices, and so much more. All with five-star customer support. BigRedCloud.com, 100% Irish-owned and a proud member of Team GBS.
All that great business show advertisers are Team GBS approved. Back them.
That great business show.
I am very often asked where we find our great guests for the podcast. Many suggestions come from lovely people like Patrick Reed, whose day job is an area sales manager at Pat the Baker Irish Pride. But he's also a one-man walking Rolodex. He keeps popping over in introductions to me on LinkedIn. And another great source has been my old pal and retired founder of accountancy firm BDO Simpson Xavier, now known as BDO, Antoine Xavier, who, given his hugely successful career, seems to know absolutely everybody. And he recommended today's second guest to me. Since 1982, Cavan-based Greenbelt has established more than 400,000 acres of new forestry across Ireland, making them the biggest forestry managers in the country. If you're a farmer looking to supplement your income, or you may have a plot of land and you actually don't know what to do with it, it's probably worth your while having a chat with Greenbelt, because they may be able to help you make money out of it. And even if you don't have land but have a bit of cash, they have funds that invest in tree growing and can pay back a tax-free sum. Tax-free? We like. Maurice Ryan is a director of Greenbelt. Welcome to That Great Business Show, Maurice Ryan.
Well, thank you, Conal.
You're going to make us all rich beyond our dreams.
And you can feel good about it as well.
You grow trees. That's what your business says.
That's
we
right.
grow trees.
Yeah, we've been planting trees for 40 years now, more than 500 million trees planted across Ireland alone. We've planted and managed forestry all across.
Say that again.
500 million trees. Half a billion trees.
In Ireland?
In Ireland alone.
I'm genuinely surprised by that. I did not realise that number.
No, it's huge.
It wasn't just you, it was the daddy started, wasn't that right?
Well, my father started with Tim O'Brien. The two of them were college friends, worked for the department and set up Greenbelt then. In 1982.
The department, presumably being Department of Lands or...
Department of Forestry, so within Department of Agriculture. So they, well, which was later brought into Department of Agriculture and ultimately now is Quilche. So they would have both trained as forestry graduates. And then saw an opportunity in the market, particularly around the idea of buying lands and planting them for pension funds and investment firms. And those two particular... companies like that in Ireland operating who were very keen on it. And then there was a historic day, Black Friday, where 10 o'clock one morning, one of them rang to say we're ceasing all activities immediately. As of today, not in 3 months or whenever the next deal round closes.
I had one of those conversations once in my life, and my God,
he had two in the one day, because at 2 o'clock the second one rang.
Oh my God.
That was a quiet day, a quiet weekend, as you can imagine, in our house. So I was very young, obviously, at the time. But Massey and Tim were nothing if not entrepreneurial, and certainly very resilient and diligent. And they set about working hard to develop what is now the Irish private forestry industry. And they got a lot of help from government, in fairness to Charlie Haughey. He pushed hard to develop this sector, encouraged them across to the US with some of his ministers, and they met lots of people interested in forestry from the US, and that kept things going. And we, the Royal We, Greenbelt helped develop what is now the grant and premium scheme that exists in Ireland, where farmers or landowners get a grant to cover the establishment cost of forests and receive an annual tax-free payment for 15 years for as what would have been a subsidy, which is now as an annual tax-free payment. So that was sort of late 80s, early 90s as it evolved. And the business has evolved ever since. So we've grown from a two-person show with my mum throwing in a few hours here and there to now employing 30 full-time staff across Ireland, full-time across Ireland. So we're based out of Virginia, where we've always been based. It's been a topsy-turvy few years in the last couple of years as the Department of Agriculture have miserably failed to deliver on any of their obligations.
Now, explain that, because our listeners, you obviously live, eat, breathe, and probably ingest trees. You know what's going on. Most people do not.
You mentioned this studio is your happy place. Mine is in the middle of a forest. Luckily, I get paid to walk into a forest and assess it for people and manage it and so forth. So within the private forest industry, it's very heavily regulated by the Forest Service, which is administered by the Department of Agriculture. Regulation is very important, obviously, because it monitors all the environmental aspects and makes sure that the right tree goes in the right place and so on and so forth. And it helps develop a program and gets funding for that program. The government have stated that they need an average of a minimum of 8,000 hectares of forestry, new forestry planted every year. This year, we're going to plant less than 1,800 hectares, 1,800 hectares. Next year, it's looking likely to be about 1,200 hectares. That's not getting closer to 8,000 hectares. And it hasn't been close to 8,000 hectares in many, many years.
And what be the problem?
I'm conscious of trying to be polite.
But don't say you're on a podcast. It's our podcast.
It's difficult to say in a precise manner, but it does seem to be a huge level of inactivity / inability by the Forest Service to actually deliver on this program. Is it a lack of appetite or what? I don't know.
But it's not costing money, is it? It's not costing the state money.
But it isn't now because they're not issuing any grants.
But is that...
But it's costing them money because they've employed 30 ecologists, 30 plus ecologists to work through this process to make sure that licenses can be delivered. However, there's only one ecologist can sign off on all of each of those files. So that's like having a football team where only one person can score.
I see. There's only one person amongst those 30.
Yeah. So no matter how much work they can do, only one person can oversee it and sign off.
What's the thinking behind that?
Well, you're assumed as thinking. So, and that's one issue within it.
That sounds like balderdash.
But
is there not a minister in charge of this? Who's the minister? Name that name, please.
Pippa Hackett is a super junior minister with direct charge over forestry. And she answers to Minister McConnellogue, who's the Minister for Agriculture. And unfortunately, it just does not seem to be working.
You're skirting around something. Now, you have to inform me because I do not know what you're trying to say. Who's to blame? Come on.
This is a podcast. Yeah. I notice you have more than 60,000 subscribers now.
We do.
I wonder,
happy days.
Our friend Pippa.
I will be tagging Pippa and Minister McConnellogue and others on this. But name that name. Point that finger, please.
I'm very conscious of being one company in this industry. And
the biggest.
We work very, very hard to, I remember the tagline from, was it Avis in the 80s saying we're number two, so we try harder. Well, we're number one because we try harder. I'm sure that'll reach some challenges. But anyway, so there's a numerous challenges within it. The administrators, the civil servants, if you will, within the Forest Service are in control of this scenario and they're not making licensing happen. It's a simple process. You understand, everybody in business understands processes. Whether you're making widgets, whether you're processing paperwork, there is a process. And I can understand there can be issues around processes because new aspects and new features appear in those processes. We've been at a standstill ultimately, and even worse, in a state of reverse for over 5 years now. 5 years. So I remember speaking with a very important client of ours in November 2018, where this issue persisted for over a year, where his licensing for numerous activities within his forestry estate, and he had over 1,800 hectares of forestry under management. And we explained in November 18 that in 6 weeks, we've been promised these issues would be resolved. Fast forward nearly 4 years later, and the issues have actually become significantly worse.
What are those issues?
It is simply just a process issue. You put in an application today to plant a tree and you'll be lucky to see it exit the Forest Service with an approval within 2 years. We used to complain.
A tree is a good thing.
I'm not going to suggest that it should be done in a week because there are things to do around looking at it. So you have to look at a piece of land, okay, and assume all the aspects around it. You look at the impact putting trees on that land is going to have. And you have to look at that, the impact on watercourses, impact on habitat and birds and SAC and all those things. Very, very important.
But you have been at this since 1982. Yeah. You probably know what you're doing at this stage.
Yeah.
Half a billion trees. You're not going to put crappy trees where they shouldn't be.
Yeah, and it's not even, it's around the processes of how you cultivate the soil, how you manage the farm and so on and so forth. It is a pretty much a straightforward process, really. We've employed a full-time ecologist to assist us with the applications. We put them in as robustly as we possibly can to pre-answer any questions that may arise. So we look at all aspects of this, as do lots of other forestry companies in the country. We'd be very proud of our forest industry here. It's still relatively juvenile. It was really only burgeoned since the foundation of the state, where forest, you know, we were at 1% forestry cover in the 40s and the state started planting. But the private estate has really only taken off. You know, we were the pioneers, others followed in chronologically from there. So the huge frustration for us is that there are people who are not held accountable for their actions.
Or inactions.
Precisely. Are negatively impacting our lives and our livelihoods.
But to what end? I still cannot get my head around this.
Well, I don't understand it either. Yeah.
There's a person, gender non-specific, doesn't matter to me.
Yeah.
But that person has the power of a pen to hold everything up.
Mm.
That's not sensible. That's not government.
We would have suggested over the years many times that it would be a self-regulated system that, as you mentioned, we know what we're doing, we know where to do it. And that a selection of sites are audited on an annual basis.
Yeah.
Reasonable enough. That's been discounted because of quotation of European rules and therefore and so forth. There has to be a solution. But we have a belief a solution will be arrived at. When that will be arrived at and what the lingering and long-term damage will be is the unknown factor here. I look at across the industry and I see people who have timber harvesting machines, huge investment, and they need to be working 24/7, are now selling those machines across Europe because there's more harvesting going on across that. That's one aspect of it. I see people who've worked in this industry for 30 years leave not just the company they've worked with, the actual industry. If you're in forestry, you're not in it. You don't chance upon it. You come into it because it's a vocation to a certain degree. I don't want to romanticise it too much, but people in forestry enjoy forestry and they like that life. People leaving that industry, that's quite distressing. And that's the start of it. And there's 12,000 people, which would be probably a conservative number of full-time employees across the entire sector. And that number will grow as the timber estate grows, as the uses and opportunities around timber and timber values increases and expands around the circular economy. I mean, everybody who's listening to this, just take a moment and look, do a 360 around you and identify the amount of items that have wood or timber constituents within it. Your chair, your table, your window frames, door frames, architraves, the door. Everything that's made out of fossil fuels can be made by timber, the chemical structures within timber. The value of timber to the economy is about 2.3 billion euros, and that can more than double in the next 10 years.
If somebody...
There's enough timber in the ground at the moment, okay? And that's fudging the figures. You fast forward 15 to 20 years from now, our timber industry is going to be on its knees because there's no new timber coming on. We're going to be importing timber. We're going to be importing timber frame homes from Austria and wherever else.
The world, our world, works on a pyramid.
Yeah.
Above the aforementioned ministers and public servants, there is a Taoiseach and a Tánaiste. Have they no interest in this?
Leo Varadkar would seem to have quite an interest in it.
He's obviously not doing anything, is he?
He isn't.
Why not?
I don't know. I don't know.
I don't understand these things.
Well, I hope one of them or their staff are listening to this and actually understand it. And I come in here kind of to be positive and to try and speak about the values and virtues of forestry, of which there are many. And this can correct. If we can survive, and I talk about the industry generally, if the private forest industry can survive and it's not subsumed by Quilche, who in fairness to them are doing a wonderful job, maybe outside their remit, but they're doing a wonderful job. It's the potential within this industry is phenomenal.
Because we grow trees really well.
We have a really good soil and climate for growing trees. We have a really well-educated workforce that can manage and develop a forestry program. We have sawmills, which are really, really well catered for in terms of machinery and science. And I mean, spending time in a sawmill, it's wonderful to see the technology around, looking at a big lump of wood going in and how a computer can just define how best to cut this to get the optimum volume of quality timber out of it. It's superb. And we have a housing industry that can evolve to using timber in every aspect to build multi-story apartment blocks and office buildings solely out of timber, like cross-laminate timber and so forth. You know, so positive. So positive. It's huge. It's massive. And it needs a little bit of investment. It needs a bit of encouragement. It needs support from the government. And it's not costing the Exchequer
but
anything.
But that's my point.
The multiplier effect of forestry in Ireland is 0.75. So it's more, like, for every euro put in, 1.75 comes back.
Yeah.
And that's going to expand. That is going to expand. It's going to just...
And we're not even talking about taking the carbon out of the air because we haven't got time to, because I want you, before I ask you your final question, you better tell me about all the wonders of that you can do for people. In other words, give me the pitch to both landowners and to potential investors. You, I think, according to your website, you can invest as little as 20,000. Was that it?
Yeah. So
let's start with the landowners because you need them as well.
Yeah, the landowners are very important. Obviously, you know, as I mentioned with the issues around the licensing, we've seen fewer landowners put in applications, but it's very, very important that applications go in because that will encourage the Forest Service to act. There is a new forestry program being developed and which will be released slowly but surely from the ploughing championships, which is mid-September onwards, and that should and is likely to include better grants so companies like Greenbelt can survive on the grants that are there, and that's how it works, and the premiums to the forest owner are improved, and you'll start seeing more and more encouragements around agroforestry. So farmers who aren't inclined to plant vast tracts of complete forestry can introduce smaller volumes of trees per hectare, all the way through to commercial planting. Obviously, native woodland planting is huge. So we would be challenged on that. Even this morning, I was challenged on, are you not planting those dirty Christmas trees up the mountain? And anyway, that's another day's work. We don't have time to get into that argument. They are unique. They're wonderful. They are Irish trees because they've been, you know, they're third, fourth generation in Ireland. They're propagated from an Irish nursery. They're Irish trees and they are vital to Irish building, to Irish forestry and our forestry investment. And within that, you look at a project that we would host called FACT, which is investing into small-scale forestry to consolidate.
And I thought that was the worst acronym. What does that stand for?
Forest Acquisition, Consolidation and Timber.
Well, and the timber's just kind of thrown in there randomly.
But I had to round it up to
fact.
Yeah,
that's what I say.
Fact.
Come here to me. Somebody has 20,000 quid. What can you do for them?
Well, we put that into FACT too. They invest that over a period of 10 years. They would look at a minimum of 5% per annum compounded. There's an annual, or there's a dividend paid at the end of the term, which is 10 years, as I mentioned. And that's a tax-free dividend. So that's a 5%
right.
Tax-free. That is very all right.
Yeah.
That is very, very all right. And actually,
mixed.
With that, so the land, the underlying land asset is then sold as the company has dissolved the land, and the return from that, the potential is to donate that money to Peter McVerry Trust.
Well, that's even cooler.
Yeah, it is. It is. Yeah. Because, and what the logic with that was, they obviously provide social housing and homes, and an awful lot, when you walk through them, it's all Irish timber they have in it, and so it should be. And we would see that as a lovely sort of cycle and circle of life, you know.
Final question. Who would Maurice Ryan hire in a heartbeat?
When you sent this to me, I was thinking about it, and I thought of lots of different people, and I thought of someone like Ronan O'Gara from his drive and mentality, and then I thought a little bit further about it, and actually there was two people that I chose, and actually we're already very lucky, we have them in staff already. So my father, who has more rings on his tree than most, and knows more about forestry.
And he is Mossy, is that what
Mossy
you call him?
Ryan, yeah.
Mossy,
yeah.
Ryan,
so,
yeah.
Funny story how he called Mossy, but he,
it's short for Morris, isn't it?
Yeah, but his name is actually Michael.
Okay.
But there was three Michaels in his class. He was born closest to Michaelmas, so he was called Mossy, and that's how it comes around. There
okay,
you go.
I'm sure
there is
some
logic
sense
there
in that.
Somewhere, yeah. And he's a wealth of information and knowledge. I mean, that no book will ever answer. And I find that no matter how big a problem is, and actually the bigger the problem is, when I approach him with it, the calmer and more reasoned his approach is to the bigger the problem, because there's nothing he hasn't
benefit
seen.
Benefit of age.
100%.
Okay.
And the other person that I would like to employ, and thankfully we have in our employ, is Imelda Connolly, who's our chief executive officer. And she entered the company about 2.5 years ago and has, and it's not an overstatement to say, revolutionized the business, our own business. She's brought clarity, direction, structure. She's tethered my enthusiasm, which has been a positive. She's brought confidence back to all our staff, and actually made us a much better place to work and a better company to be in. And the future is much brighter with her at the helm.
Well, normally we say, Mossy and Imelda, you're hired. But Mossy and Imelda, you're already hired.
Yeah.
Maurice Ryan, Director of Greenbelt Forestry Services, thank you so much for joining us on That Great Business Show.
Thank you, Conal.
Everyday accounting can be a bit of a drama for SMEs. However, BigRentCloud.com takes the drama away with its simple and easy-to-use cloud-based accounting and payroll software designed for SME owners. Raise and send invoices, manage VAT reports and obligations, run management reports, link directly to Irish banks, automatically import purchase invoices, and so much more. All with 5-star customer support. BigRentCloud.com, 100% Irish-owned and a proud member of Team GBS.
Viscosity. When you shave, you want the highest viscosity because it helps the blade run smoother. DeFacto, the world's best shaving oil, has incredible viscosity. That's why DeFacto leaves your face, underarms or legs nick-free. Higher viscosity makes blades last longer. DeFacto is the best for your skin and your pocket. DeFactoShave.com.
All That Great Business Show advertisers are Team GBS approved. Back them.
In a minute, we will be looking at businesses who are trying to copyright colour. But first, I promised the ladies at Awaken Hub I'd give them a shout out for their second birthday. Happy birthday to them. On episode 54, we had mayhem in studio when the Hubbers joined me to tell me about how their 2,000 members are supporting female entrepreneurs. On Tuesday, the 5th of July, they're having an online event that they very kindly asked Ross Finnegan of Lonsdale Capital Partners and Damien Kennedy, a serial entrepreneur and investor, along with myself, to participate in, and we were delighted. They're great people, led by 5 Irish women. And all the information is available on awakenhub.com, including an open call for expressions of interest for their sponsored She Generate Women Founders program. These women are deadly serious about what they do, but they always make it fun. So do tune in. It's an online event. awakenhub.com. 5th of July, 5 p.m. And so to the sneaky business of trying to copyright a colour. Everyone in business knows the usual blather that business is, oh, we welcome competition and that competition is good for business. Of course, no one really believes that. If they could, most businesses would close down all of their competitors, or, failing that, they sometimes try to use the law to try to get an unfair advantage on their rivals. Take, for example, the use of colour in business. Colour is very important to a brand. When you're looking for a Kit Kat, the red wrapper of a certain hue is an immediate identifier, or the yellow M is synonymous with McDonald's, and purple screams Cadbury. So, did you know, in the spirit of unfair competition, that some businesses have tried to copyright a colour to make what is given to us by nature their own property? When I read this, I needed to know more. So who else could I call on but Team GBS's own friend in court, Barrister Peter Leonard, co-presenter of the award-winning, we'll be talking about that, podcast Law on Trial, who has been looking into this curious, if not devious, corner of the business world. Welcome back to That Great Business Show,
Peter.
Thank you,
Conal. Wonderful to be back, as always. Wonderful to be back, as always.
Award-winning. Come here. Well, Have you been winning awards?
Thank you. Yes. Well, I suppose one should share the good news with the world.
What did you win?
Yeah, we were, as you know, we do a legal podcast, Law on Trial, in association with the Business Post. And we were nominated for one of the Justice Media Awards. And they're the awards that are run by the Law Society. So they're kind of top of the pops when it comes to the Oscars of
quality.
Law. The Oscars of Law. God, I'm really overselling this. But anyway, so I was invited along for what I thought was a free lunch, which I will always take. And it was a very enjoyable lunch. And we were one of 12 nominees in the category for best podcast, legal podcast, podcast on a legal theme. Or anyway, so and lo and behold, we emerged as the winner. which was great. And we were cited as being the winner because we had brought kind of explained complex legal issues in simple language with kind of an element of entertainment and fun. And also that we had interviewed some high profile legal personalities and brought them to a wider public and explained their importance to the wider public. So it was very nice. I have to say it was very nice.
I know you're a pal. I know you're sitting in front of me. It is a lovely podcast. It
great.
Really is.
Well, thank you, Colonel.
I listen.
Thank you.
I find it interesting. Quirky stuff. Really
but
interesting
you know
stuff.
What? Kind of awards, and I was kind of thinking this is no big deal, you know, but actually when you hear the winner is and you have to push back the chair and you shake hands with a few people at the table, it's kind of cool. I have to say, it was kind of cool.
Everybody so was hoping that you were buying the round.
Well, that was it. Oh, yeah. Oh, no, there was plenty of drink bought afterwards. So we're delighted with it. Anyway, look, that's it's nice to get a pat on the back, you know.
Well, come here to me. First question, explain the difference to me, please, between, do you know the difference between a trademark, a copyright and a patent?
Well, I kind of do. Of course I do. I mean, it's all about legislation and it's all about definitions. We had a bit of fun here on this show some weeks ago when we talked about trademarks and Paris Hilton and Arnold Schwarzenegger, wasn't that it? We had all those, the trademarks. So I suppose a trademark is a sign that signifies a product, and it can be anything. It can be a combination of words. It can be a shape. It can be a colour. And I know that's what we're talking about today.
It can be the Nike tick.
Nike tick, I think, was the star on the car we were talking about in Mercedes. It can be that little symbol. So it's not the product itself. It's the symbol that represents the product. And then I suppose you have copyright. And in copyright, you have an author. And the author can be a person who writes a book, writes an article, writes a musical opera, creates anything, and they are the person who is the creator. So they're deemed to be the author at law in the Irish copyright legislation, which goes back to 2000. And, you know, and then they have control over their product, what they have created, and they have the right then to give to assign copyright rights to other individuals. People have to pay the money for it. So they own it, and we all know what that means, but they have the right then to pass it on to other individuals and be well remunerated for doing same.
Some of them will say they aren't well remunerated, but there you go. And then finally, the patent?
Well, the patent is to do with creation, invention. So you create something and you invent something, and it has to be applicable to industry. And if you have done something that is new, is novel, and is applicable, it has an industrial application, and it is, you know, it advances the world of industry, well, then you can get a patent on that and nobody can mess with that. Now, you can only get a patent for about 20 years. That's it. Copyright, you get about 70 years. Trademark, you get a long time as well. But a patent is for 20 years. But that's,
so that's for the better mousetrap and stuff like that.
Yes, the better mousetrap.
Now, what did you make of this stuff about copywriting a colour?
Well, I mean, it's entirely feasible. It's weird. You know, there are only so many colours out there. Was it Johnny Cash, 40 Shades of Green? Is that it?
Well remembered. Are you that old?
I am that old, yeah. Well, you know, but they still play it on the radio these days as well, Cuddle, I hope. So yeah, 40 Shades of Green. But I think there's only X amount of colours. So
there's
you
about
know,
1,300 or something Pantone colours.
Now, it's wasted on me, sadly, because I'm a bit colourblind. I think technically I'm red-green deficient. So yeah, you know. So
I mean, Vodafone, if I asked you what colour Vodafone works off or what
well, that I know because it's a very clear colour. It's red.
Okay.
But if it was like one of the cases we're going to talk about here, the colour is magenta.
Yeah.
Now, I don't know what magenta is. I mean,
I never thought about that. Okay. You've opened up my eyes.
I don't know what magenta is. But anyway, you know, I thought it was a reference to the Christy Moore song. But anyway, there you go.
But these people, now, first of all, if I'm right, the colour comes from nature. And then these businesses are trying to capture what nature has given them and make it their own. Doesn't sound right.
Everything comes from somewhere. Do you know what I mean? So, I mean, if you have a symbol, it is a creation or it's a representation of something. Like, for example, Nike. You wouldn't, you know, we all know the little tick and stuff like that, but the tick existed before Nike existed. But then they subsumed it into their product and their brand and stuff like that. So, yes, I mean, those, you know, golden hues that you see every morning when you look out the window. Yeah, they're natural, but people can associate them with products. For example, one of the cases that we looked at in relation to this was Cadbury's. And I mean, anybody who goes into the shop and buys a bar of chocolate, they know that Cadbury's have that purple-looking packaging, if you know what I mean. Now, if you look at the logo, we know the sign. It's kind of like handwritten, the Cadbury's thing, against a purple logo. That's the logo. That's the trademark. But they also claimed that, and they also took out a trademark on the purple packaging on the bar. And they were challenged by Nestlé. Why? I don't know, because I don't think Nestlé used purple packaging, but they just didn't like the idea of Cadbury's owning this colour and having this colour all to themselves. And there was a bit of a row about the colour, the packaging in Kit Kat as well. I'm not 100% sure about that. But at the end of the day, the colour in itself was not something that Cadbury's could own, but they could own it in the shape of a bar. So if it was that rectangular shape with those little indents for the various different pieces of chocolate, that was a way that you could manage the colour and use the colour, and therefore they could, you know, that was a kind of a blast of colour in that shape. So it was colour and shape together, and it represented dairy milk chocolate. Now, they couldn't use it for plain chocolate, which I don't think is dairy milk, or maybe it is, I don't know, but that was it. So it is specific, so the colour has to be in a specific context.
The magenta that you mentioned.
Yes.
This is when it becomes quite serious.
Yes. Well, this is to do with Deutsche Telekom, who are also responsible for T-Mobile. So they're a major international telecommunications company
and
based.
And beyond, because that becomes relevant as well. I mean,
yes.
They have fingers in many, many, many pies.
Yes. And their colour is magenta, the said magenta. And
I have to find out. What do you think magenta looks like?
Is it a kind of a purple colour or something?
It is.
I would kind of have a handle. A maroon sort of thing. That's what
but
I was thinking.
It's lighter than that, yeah.
Is it lighter than maroon? Okay. Yeah. Okay. This is an education. This show has always been an education for me, Connell. But anyway, so magenta is the colour that they have, and woe betide anybody who tries to put a touch of magenta on any of their products. They go after them like there's no tomorrow. So, I mean, they obviously see great value in associating a colour with their product. I mean, a good example, I thought, was the UPS vans, if you know what I mean. They are a distinct colour. And the logo is very small. So if you see one of those vans, if some fella pulls across you in one of those vans, you'd be ringing up the complaints department in UPS, wouldn't you? Do you know what I mean? You know, you mightn't see the logo. So if other people were using that, you could understand why the colour there in that case is so important.
And
anyway,
the brown colour is the least favourite of all the colours.
Absolutely.
Which is interesting.
Number one, top of the charts, counting down. Number one is
red or a blue?
No,
or
it's blue. So it's blue. Apparently, is the best color to be associated with, which is fresh and it's airy and it's the blue sky and it makes us all feel good. And then it goes through it. Anyway, let's go back to Deutsche Telekom.
Lord, I think he's wasting the court's time.
Yes, I'm banging on here, Cuddle, banging on here. But anyway, so Deutsche Telekom. Anyway, they took on a company called Lemonade, but they also took on, which I found very interesting, was a company called EndGadgetMobile.com.
I read, it's a newsletter, and I read Engadget, and I wasn't aware of this. It was on their tech piece that they put the same colour.
Yes.
And it was that cheesed off.
Deutsche Telekom. Yeah. And they went after them big time. But before they went after them and went into court, what do you do before you go to court? You have to write a letter and put your opponent on notice that you're not happy. And you ask them to rectify things before we go in and spend all that money and give money to people like me to get up in court and start banging on. So this is the letter, and I think it's cool. So I'm going to read it out to you.
Please do.
If you don't mind. Okay. Dear Miss Maffitt. So Miss Maffitt was obviously a person from Engadget Mobile. We write to you today regarding certain trademark issues concerning the use by Weblogs Inc. of the colour magenta on your website, EndGadgetMobile.com. Specifically, we have recently learned that your company is using the colour magenta in the logo of the EndGadget Mobile news blog, in which you feature new developments in the field of mobile technology, including reports on our company and our products. So they're very good. And it says, then move on, skip on a little bit. He says, as you are likely aware, Deutsche Telekom and its whole group, including the T-Mobile companies worldwide, have been using the colour magenta as a company identifier and core branding element for many years. The company has achieved an especially high awareness of our branding efforts in this area of mobile communication due to the extensive use of the colour magenta by our T-Mobile entities. So this is kind of a way of giving a background to the case. And then they said, back off. Don't use this colour. This colour is ours. We own it. And we're going to fight you on it.
How much did that letter cost? Maybe €5,000 or something?
Well, I'm sure. You know, it's a very impressive letter, is it? I don't think so. But anyway, so the point being that this is
what they... That's just bullying.
Yeah. I mean, no, it is bullying.
Shag
it is bullying.
Off, basically.
But at the end of the day, just like your purple chocolate bar that I told you, if you go into a shop and everybody is dashing in and you want to grab something quickly because you're about to get on the Lewis or you're about to do whatever, you know, you will identify a chocolate bar, a Cadbury's bar, by the purple packaging. Isn't that the case?
Yes, it is.
So therefore,
course, yeah,
there is value in it. There's a property right. It is trademarked, and therefore there is a value to the commercial entity.
And I think it was you who told me that it all came out of insulation, house insulation.
Yes, 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 yes. And that was the famous one in America. And this was a company called Owens Corning in the 1950s.
Vast.
Yeah, I never heard of these before. But this is the insulation you put in your attic, you know, to try and keep the heat in.
Fiberglass stuff,
especially these days with soaring domestic bills. So they were trying to get a competitive advantage over their competitors. And they didn't like this ugly yellowy colour. I think it's a yellowy colour. I say this as a colourblind person. But I think the yellowy colour of this insulation, these rolls of insulation, this kind of foamy stuff that you put up into your attic. So they put the colour pink on theirs, and they thought this was very distinctive. And they used the Pink Panther as their kind of advertising logo and all this sort of stuff. So pink, pink, pink. They were the pink insulator. Now, I never heard of a pink insulator in my life, but they said it was very valuable to them. And
when you think of insulation, if you think of fiberglass, do you not remember rolls and rolls of that horrible stuff?
Mm.
And it was pink.
Was it pink?
Well, it was either that yellow kind of hay colour.
Yeah, hay colour, that I remember.
But the good stuff, presumably, was the pink,
pink
stuff.
Pink.
Well,
that's what they were saying. So that's what they were saying. And yeah, and it had a value. And therefore, maybe people would go in. And people who were in the trade, like this would be bought by people in the trade. Mm. So, I mean, if there was an extra premium on that, then it was very important that they held on to the colour pink. They went to the court in America. And in 1985, they got a trademark on the colour pink. So you can, you know, it's a bit like the old classic Henry Ford line. You can have any colour you want as long as it's pink in relation to this form of fiberglass insulation.
And tell me, does all of this, the above, does it apply in dear old Ireland? Because a lot of these cases are international there.
It certainly does. But before I get on to that, can I ask you, what happens if there's no colour at all? Wow. There's the six mark question.
Now, what do you mean no colour at all?
Dyson, the famous Dyson vacuum cleaners, they tried to get a patent on their transparent box, you know, the thing that they have on their Hoover or whatever. Now,
but
Hoover, of course, being
Dyson
a different product.
Was to me, is yellow and purple, for example.
Is it? Okay.
You probably
wouldn't
know that.
I haven't a clue. But they kind of developed a product, and when you Hoover the stairs, and I can't really say Hoover because Hoover is a product, isn't it? I'm kind of, you know, I'm breaking every trick in the book. When you vacuum the stairs, all the dirt and the dust and all went into this see-through box at the top. And they said, well, this is a distinguishing trademark for our product, which is kind of, there's probably something there. But they lost. They lost because they had a variety of vacuum cleaners and they were different shapes and sizes. So unlike our chocolate bar, going back to Cadbury's again, which was a rectangular shape that everybody associated with it, it was colour in association with shape. In this case, it was transparency for different sizes and shapes. And it didn't work. And the European Patents, our trademarks office said, no, you're not going to get a trademark on that.
So in terms of a copyright, which is the over, which trumps what in Ireland? If I go for a copyright in Ireland.
Yes.
Do I have to get one in Europe, across Europe? Or which is the more important one?
Well, you get it in Ireland, but then you'd also apply to the European Union and you can get that. There is an international system and then there's a worldwide system as well. So the copyright exists internationally. It's no good if it just exists in Ireland because then somebody gets, an Irish book or something and then, you know, publishes it in England. So it has international application. And that's through various treaties that have been signed and established over the years.
And so I can copyright a colour here.
Yes, you can.
I'll go back to the Cadbury's bar. It has to have a function with
it. It has
word?
To be a function and it has to have a secondary value. It, in order to have, like, the colour has to be arbitrary. It can't be part of the product, if you know what I mean. So, like, purple, I mean, Cadbury's, when they made that chocolate bar all those years ago, the Quakers gathering together in Birmingham 150 years ago, if they put it in a yellow package, that would be fine. So purple doesn't really mean anything. It doesn't have any value in the context of the product.
Except when it comes to your friend and mine, the late lamented Prince, rock star, he or his estate.
They're trying to get to get a trademark on the colour purple because he was the purple one and Paisley Park and all that sort of stuff.
Even Purple Rain?
Purple Rain, of course, you know. But I don't know whether they're going to succeed in that. You know, yes, I mean, in the context of music or maybe in an LP or something, or CDs, is that
LP.
What you call it?
Brian a is long beginning playing to record. Say, what the hell is he talking about?
Or, you know, a 45 single. No, but the point is, if it's associated with music, but they can't own the colour purple, you know, in terms of, they have to narrow it down. It has to be specific. It has to have a shape. It has to have a context. But they could get it in on that basis.
Finally, you know what I'm going to ask you?
Yes.
Because I keep asking you this and you keep coming up with new names. Yeah. Who would Peter Leonard BL hire in a heartbeat?
So my hire in a heartbeat this week, Connell, is one Richard Shakespeare. Have you ever heard of him?
Yeah, but you see, I know what you are actually going to say. You're not talking about the guy who wrote all the lovely poems and the lovely plays and
was
all that.
Was that William Shakespeare, no?
Oh, Jesus, you're right. Jesus.
This is a guy called Richard Shakespeare, and he's
whom
a very important
whom
job.
I know.
Yes, and who's a wonderful man, okay? And but I don't know personally. I just know
I'm
him by reputation.
I'm going to have to edit that out now, you know.
No,
that.
No, that's okay. That's okay. It's just, you know, as I, we won't quote the bard, to be or not to be. But Richard Shakespeare is currently the assistant chief executive of Dublin City Council. Very serious geezer, wonderful public servant. And the reason I am nominating him today is because I live in Rathfarnham and I'm also a member of Ballantyre St. John's GAA Club. So as doing my civic duty and my duty to the GAA Club, I was a steward for a number of concerts in Marley Park in the last couple of days. Guns N' Roses. I think you were up the front. Was that you that kind of did the mosh pit? I thought that was you anyway, Connell. And Red Hot Chili Peppers and Green Day, okay? And Richard Shakespeare is the man who previously, in a previous life, used to work for Dunleary Rathdown County Council. He was in charge of parks and a very eminent public servant in Dunleary Rathdown County Council. And he was the man who got the ball rolling and started the concerts in Marley Park. And I think they're fantastic. Now, there's a lot of people who moan about traffic congestion and, you know, noise. No, 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 no. Let the kids rock. Let the kids rock.
Let so I think Peter it's fantastic. Leonard rock.
Well, actually, there was very few kids there. I was, as I said, I was stewarding for Guns N' Roses. I think the average age was about 60. But anyway, there you go. You know,
Peter, as always, thank you very much for joining us on That Great Business Show. And that is it from That Great Business Show, episode 94. Share this podcast with your pals. Just dump a link into your WhatsApp and send it to your pals in business. Then they can all listen in the car, walking the dog, watching the kids play, or even going to Guns N' Roses. They'll love you if you do that. We also want your ads. Brilliant brands like Big Red Cloud, Microfinance Ireland, is me, Virgin Media, Udros Nogatuchta advertise with us. So why does your business not do the same? We work with our great friends here at the Dublin South Podcast Studios, including sound engineer Brian Black and White Begley, who makes our podcasts super sharp. And later on, studio manager Peter Rice adds in a touch of colour to the sound to make us the world's finest. And if you want to record a podcast, I cannot recommend the team here at the Dublin South Podcast Studios highly enough. If you'd like the media group to produce a podcast for you, as we do for the Love Irish Food Group and others, then I am your Buchel. Talk to me, please. All of our great business insights and tips are brought to you, as always, thanks to our sponsor, De Facto Shaving Oil, the world's best all-natural shaving oil. They back us, please back them. DeFactoShave.com will get them. And don't forget to buy Business Plus magazine, where we now have a regular column all about the podcast. So, from me, Conal O'Moran, Míle Buíochas for listening, and Slán Tomlin.